Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
Why is Denmark unwelcoming to refugees? To answer this question, I am joined today by Michelle Putsch to talk about her recent book, Unwelcome to Denmark, A Paradigm Shift and Refugee Integration, written with Sarah Al-Abd and published late last year by Manchester University Press. Michelle Putsch is Professor in Global Studies based in Roskilde, Denmark, an Associate Fellow in the Europe Programme at Chatham House in London, and an upcoming Visiting Fellow at the Refugee Studies Centre at Oxford University. During her time at the University of Birmingham, she was officially designated and identified as one of the university's public intellectuals. More recently, Michelle has been the Danish lead partner on two recent Horizon Europe projects, and prior to that, principal investigator on British Academy and Economic and Social Research Council funded projects. She is an interdisciplinary scholar with her research and teaching focusing on the intersections between European, Middle East, critical migration, democratization, and peace and conflict studies. As well as the book we will be talking about today, she is the author of a number of other books, including most recently, Knowledge Production in Higher Education Between Europe and the Middle East, published by Manchester University Press in 2023, The Routledge Handbook of EU-Middle East Relations, published in 2021, and The Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, The Theatrics of Woeful Statecraft, also published by Routledge in 2019. Welcome to the Voices podcast, Michelle, and thank you for joining us today.
So Thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you. I want to start by asking you about the motivation behind this book, Unwelcome to Denmark. How did you come to write it, and why is it important to focus on Denmark in this instance?
Great question. So I came to Denmark together with my family in 2014-15. So this was quite a critical moment in terms of course, the so-called refugee crisis. And I guess looking back now, and I do actually refer to this in the book, one of the things that really struck me was a concern about this gap between how a state represents itself and how it actually then governs mobility in practice. So why Denmark? Denmark strikes me as a small state that really has a challenge with multiculturalism. So on the one hand, both internally and externally, it's highly regarded as a liberal, egalitarian, humanitarian country and society. Yet what I have observed and researched to a great extent over the past decade or so is that for approximately two decades, so we're thinking here around the first turn of the millennium, Denmark has developed one of probably the most restrictive asylum and integration regimes that we have in Europe. And its own regime is modeled upon Australia's, which is infamous for its restrictive regime. So I think, you know, this contradiction is striking, and it does demand closer scrutiny because of where we are today across Europe. So are motivated by the sense that Denmark is not just simply what we call an outlier or an anomaly, but Denmark has become this kind of laboratory for understanding the broader European dynamics that we see today. So while Denmark, on the one hand, we could argue pioneered issues like temporary protection, deterrence through welfare retrenchment, conditional integration, framing of refugees as a burden or as a threat, these ideas have traveled very quickly elsewhere. And I would say, of course, now they have spread across Europe. So I believe that focusing on Denmark allows us to really witness and see how exclusionary policies can be normalized and also legitimized. So my concern is that all this has been happening within the framing of a self-identified liberal democracy. And that is what brings this to my mind of crucial importance to understand, because we are witnessing a very quick backsliding in long-established democracies across Europe.
Now, as you say, the book addresses the policies that make the Danish asylum regime one of the harshest in Europe, which you, of course, argue contrasts with the liberal, the social democratic, the hygge, sort of friendly identity that Denmark likes to promote to the outside world. And I think many of us in other European countries can also recognize those dynamics in our own societies. And these asylum and migration policies are of course, perhaps known to some of our listeners, right? We especially recently, we've seen talk of sort of, you know, the Danish model being implemented elsewhere. But can you explain to us in more detail what it is that makes Denmark unwelcoming to refugees and the genealogy of these policies? When did they start? How have they developed over time?
So I'll start by kind of linking up to your previous question, because this is really important and it's a very, very crucial question. So the book is not just about Denmark. I think it's important for listeners to understand that Denmark offers us a lens through which to understand these wider transformations in asylum governance, in issues of state sovereignty and issues of belonging and non-belonging across Europe and beyond the European continent. So the book also builds a theoretical framing of the unwelcome refugee. And this is not just about the extent and severity of individual policies that Denmark has been working on over these years, but more importantly, I think, the manner in which these policies have been so coherently assembled into what I call in the book a migration regime. And this regime is extremely and specifically designed around deterrence, temporary residency permit, which I refer to the book as permanent temporariness, and this notion of conditional belonging. So if you are a refugee in Denmark, you are not imagined as a future active member of this society, but you are a guest. And ideally, you should return as soon as possible to the country where you came from. So this is quite important. Now, in terms of key features and in terms of genealogy, it's important to remember that the book traces quite a long durée of trying to understand how is it that we came to where we are today. And there is a seminal moment in history in 1864 when Denmark experienced a national trauma. This was what is called the Schleswig War, and there's even a documentary series about it. So in short, Denmark lost land to what was then Prussia, and also many Danish soldiers lost their lives. So this was truly a national trauma. And it was a moment when the country and the nation came together and decided that, you know, the notion of homogeneity will be protected at all costs. And, you know, critical migration scholarship shows that in general, countries that lose land will become very anti-foreign. So it's about the protection of the sovereign. So this is very important because the so-called paradigm shift doesn't just come all of a sudden in 2019. There's this kind of long durée. So the book also traces the period between 1893 and 1929, when, for example, Polish people used to come and work on farms with the possibility to go, for example, back to Poland in Christmas. So the idea was that they would fill labor shortages, but then always, you know, be able to go back to their home. But of course, as time went by and during the First World War, so many Polish people returned, but then also some stayed. And the same happened if we fast forward to the 1960s and 70s, when we had the so-called Gastarbeiter scheme, with people coming from different continents, Pakistan, Yugoslavia, which was then Yugoslavia. People were invited here as guest laborers, but people also formed ties with this country. They built, you know, a whole family repertoire, having children going to Danish schools, etc. So while the idea was that these guest laborers come and leave, some stayed and established families. So then we fast forward to 2001, when we had 9/11, of course, and we start observing this very harsh rhetoric about anything deemed to be Muslim or what is termed here as non-Western origin. And then, of course, we had in 2005 the so-called Muhammad Khartoum crisis, where again, the narrative about otherness and about people with Muslim heritage was severely harsh. And then this continued in the 2010s, and then we come to the so-called refugee crisis. So, you know, genealogically, these policies emerge over this period of time, and the book argues it crystallizes in the so-called paradigm shift, right? So it's not this one moment in time. And I think the idea of explaining this in the book is to also show, and I have a separate chapter on this, that alongside these policies, there was also quite a shockingly number of amendments to the so-called Aliens Act. And the book traces these amendments. So these legal changes were happening at the same time as the policies and the narrative became harsher. And I think it's important for the listeners to also understand that these harsh actions, whether legal or narrative-wise, were not driven slowly by the Progress Party, which then developed into the Danish People's Party, but these became the mainstream political narrative. So it's quite, you know, crucial to understand how these harsh measures became normalized through technocratic measures, through even humanitarian language, you know, speaking about protecting our welfare state, you know, making sure that we have social cohesion, etc., etc. So, you know, the book traces how crucial it is that we understand that this is not just a one-time shift, as most of the politicians try to persuade us.
Thank you. That was a really in-depth answer, and I think it's a fascinating answer actually to sort of help us understand the ways in which, you know, these policies are perhaps not as new as we like to think. And I think we always think we live in unprecedented and interesting times where all the things that we are seeing are new always. And actually, I think it's really important to understand that actually a lot of what we're seeing are echoes or repetitions of things that have gone before. So it seems then when thinking about Danish unwelcome culture or wider unwelcome culture, I think it's important, as you say, that we should not just think about that this is only relevant to Denmark in this instance, that we need to talk about race. So how does race work here to shape the policies and practices that you discuss in the book?
So the book clearly has a very important message about race in Denmark. Race is a very contentious subject to even discuss in Denmark, but race is central in the book's, you know, understanding of how we came to this harsh migration regime today. So although it's not explicitly named as racism, it's entrenched in all these policies and legal amendments that I've been talking about. So on the one hand, Denmark understands itself as racially homogeneous and also colorblind. Paradoxically, this makes race much harder to contest and critique. So there is also, you know, a kind of governance structure around notions of what is race. So one important thing that the book shows is how these racialized distinctions that I've been talking about, Western, non-Western, how they operate through what I call proxies, such as culture, religion, non-Western background, integration capacity, particularly, as I said, the emphasis on Muslim and racialized refugees. So there is a very serious disproportion of how certain groups in the society are constructed, how they are narrated as being incompatible with Danish values without necessarily, you know, explicating what we mean by these values, how these groups in society do not relate to our belief in gender equality, in the notion of social trust. So these kind of assumptions, which are repeated through, you know, these political narratives, these assumptions are then used to justify these exceptional measures. So the jewelry law, the ghetto law, I mean, even the language itself, right, is reminiscent of what happened during the Nazi regime, right? So, you know, the measures include, for instance, heightened surveillance of people of non-Western background, these spatial segregations, these conditional rights. I mean, these are serious, you know, challenges to the very normative regulations that Denmark is privy to. So starting with the Convention in 51, its Protocol in 67, the European Dublin Regulation, European Asylum System, European Convention on Human Rights, etc. So I think what the book also traces is the evisceration of protection itself through these, you know, technical and highly harsh measures. So race works temporarily in ways that some groups are imagined to be permanently out of place, regardless of how long, by the way, they have lived in this country. So I've also had in the classroom second and third and fourth generation, people with heritage from Iran, Iraq, Palestine, Pakistan, etc. And even though they have been born here, they've lived here, they've been educated here, they work here, they are still not deemed to be Danish enough, right? So there is this on the one hand, and then there is this idea that even if you are legally included, so the mention of second, third, and fourth generation, it does not necessarily translate into social, political belonging. And this is quite a stark, I think, understanding of the racial logic that underpins the notion of the unwelcome regime. So it's not just about the people who came in 2014-15. So even when the language used is ostensibly neutral or administrative, it has harsh repercussions for those that it targets. So the effect is quite profound and multilayered. And the experience that I have witnessed by interviewing, you know, unaccompanied children who came from Syria from 2014 up until 2024 shows that this leaves a huge mark on people in terms of prolonged uncertainty, some even living in what we deem to be poverty levels, having this huge restriction on access to issues like education, work, family life, the notion that you are not able to plan your future, you cannot invest in relationships, you feel insecure in your everyday life, etc., etc., etc. So there are some serious repercussions to be also appreciated of these harsh migration regimes.
Thank you. I think many of us, especially maybe those of us, for example, in the Netherlands, recognize very much the way that you talk about how race is working in the Danish context. We have very similar dynamics here in the Dutch context. It's very recognizable to me being here in the Netherlands. Now, you started to talk about this already. So my next question is, what are then the effects of this unwelcoming regime on those refugees and migrants who encounter it?
So the book covers three groups. So there is a section on the impact on refugees. There's also a section on the effects that this harsh migration regime has on welfare professionals who are tasked to support refugees and inform them about their rights once they are granted asylum. And then a third group is private employers. So when the government's integration programs do not work because they don't have sufficient funding, for example, it is up to private employers, who of course need to plan in the long run, right, to create their own integration programs. And then the advantage is that a private company, for example, can make sure that if they're going to invest in these young refugees, they're going to invest for the long durée. So it's important to understand that on the one hand, we have these really chronic, I would call them, psychological stress factors that we observe in refugees who experience these regimes on an everyday basis. So this, you know, entails severe anxiety, the sense of being permanently evaluated and surveilled and never being quite good enough. These are, you know, quotes that I remember from people that I interviewed, or, you know, the feeling of being suspended in time for those who are deemed to be returnable, but you cannot be returned because Denmark does not have a political arrangement with the regime that they want to return you to. You know, your life is suspended. In anthropology, we call this the notion of liminality. You know, never being able to move forward, not being able to go back to your country, or if you go back to your country, go back to what? If you don't know that country. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect that comes out from the interviews with welfare professionals and private employers is that it is very clear to people who are trying as best as they can to make do of the talents that refugees bring to this country, given that Denmark has a very low birth rate, people are living longer, there's a huge labor shortage in many sectors. The message that I got is that this is a conscious, political, and clear message that protection has become conditional and it is revocable. It also undermines trust in institutions. It erodes the idea of asylum as a right. So the effects do not stop at the door of refugees. They shape broader social norms about who belongs and under what conditions, if you do belong. And therefore, you know, what we have in Denmark are now spaces where this kind of discrimination is so evident. And also, people who try to contest this regime are increasingly being constrained. So frontline workers, for example, people who tried during the refugee crisis, people who tried to drive people from Denmark across the border to Sweden were fined, right? So these are, you know, governance and governmentality regimes that attempt to, you know, clearly show that while resistance is trying on the one hand to soften the effects and of the everyday effects on refugees, and while workers, for example, who are frontline workers, try to bend the rules or offer additional support or advocate quietly, policies are designed to limit any interpretive flexibility. Workers are subject to intense managerial oversight. So individualized, you know, acts of resistance have become fragile, and for many who try, they have become emotionally very costly. So, you know, there is a real tension that I address in the book between systems that the system that I call here is the migration regime, systems that rely on human actors to actually function, while simultaneously they seek to discipline them into being compliant with the deterrence-oriented goals of the government. So we are, you know, at a crossroads here. And this is why I think it's important to talk about the right to asylum and the right to protection, because the evisceration of these rights are serious concerns, again, for what I referred to earlier as backsliding in our democracies.
Yeah, I think that's really important, right? That, I mean, human rights are all of our rights, and migrants' rights are also at rights for non-migrants, right? So I think that's always been an activist call. And so I want to sort of, you started to talk about this a little bit, but I want us to now focus more specifically on possible forms of resistance, possible forms of activism. And so work on migration regimes has shown sort of often how policies and their implementations, of course, differ in practice, right? So, you know, there's a policy, but then once it becomes to be implemented by people in their everyday work, there are small spaces for discretion that facilitate, you know, small acts of resistance, even if those are only small. Is this something that you also see in Denmark? Is this something that you've also seen in your research?
So Denmark has an impressive history of volunteerism. So all my students do voluntary work, for example. And it's kind of in the DNA across society here. And one of the things that I refer to in the book is this, you know, experience that I had personally on a Friday in 2015, coming to Copenhagen Central Station, and families were coming by train from Syria after a very long journey. And normally, you know, people on a Friday here, they finish early from work, they go to have a drink with their friends, or they go to their family to start the weekend, etc. And I was so impressed with this rush of people running to these families with water, blankets, toys, you know, extending their compassion to these people arriving, you know, clearly being completely lost, not knowing what's hit them. But at the same time, understanding that they were in some kind of safe space, right? So that kind of humanitarian action and practice was so evident and remains evident up to this day. But as I said, even NGOs like Refugees Welcome, Trampoline House, these are, you know, actively seeking to give a space for people who have been granted asylum here to feel, you know, a kind of support frame in their trying to contribute to society in the best way that they can, even though they have so many, you know, drawbacks. So that remains. But as I said, there are also these parallel acts by the government to curtail any forms of humanitarian action, right? And this is, to me, what is really concerning, because it kind of touches deeply into the societal DNA that I'm talking about, you know. So it is, you know, the political government level on the one hand, and then you have this disassociation. But of course, having said that, I would argue that the country is hugely split now. And we just saw this, for instance, in the municipal elections back in November, where for the first time, the Social Democratic Party lost its mayor in Copenhagen. We are now having in a few months a national election here. And of course, there is a strong fear by the Social Democratic government and its coalition that they will lose quite a number of votes to the Danish People's Party, because Messerschmidt, who is the head of the Danish People's Party, has been talking about re-migration. So the idea is that those who have been granted citizenship in the last 20 years will have their citizenship revoked, and we send as many people back to where they came from, as many as possible. So, you know, the rhetoric is getting harsher. So the space for humanitarian action is being squeezed, you know, in this kind of discourse about we're protecting Denmark for Danes, we're protecting Danish values. And as we know, this is becoming the running rhetoric across Europe, unfortunately.
Do you see any resistance or any attempts to sort of undermine some of these harsh policies by the civil service, the civil servants that are charged with kind of implementing them, or as you say, the private actors, which are also brought into to governing this migration regime? Have you uncovered, have you researched and seen any kind of resistance there?
Yes. So I was actually quite impressed. So Denmark is not really filling its diversity and inclusion quota according to the European level. So what most companies here, like IBM, Novo Nordisk, all these major companies, Maersk, what they had to do was, like we had with social, you know, corporate social responsibility some years back, they had to create these specific units called diversity and inclusion departments. And what I tasked myself by doing in this research was to actually interview the managers behind the policies of these companies. And what they said systematically is that their most loyal employees were people with a refugee background. Why? Because they always feel they have to double their act in order to prove themselves, in order to give a reason for them to be appreciated and accepted as part of society. So, you know, there is one very nice case that I quote in the book of this wonderful manager who managed to persuade women that were the target of Inga Stoiberg, a former minister of migration and integration. So Inga Stoiberg famously said that we have a big problem of integration of women with a Muslim background. So this wonderful diversity and inclusion manager from a bus company here called Arriva, she said, okay, I'm going to take this to task. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to get these women behind the wheel. And this is so fascinating as an example, because not only did she manage, but Inga Stoiberg visited the shop floor and congratulated these women and said, how wonderful and what an example you set to this society. But of course, that was done discreetly and privately. But publicly, what Inga Stoiberg did was to have a cake on Facebook and celebrate the number of amendments that she managed to get through Parliament to restrict asylum and migration policy, right? So all private companies in Denmark have regular meetings with the high political, you know, government levels on a very intense level, pleading for the government to take into account that most refugees, particularly from places like Afghanistan and Syria, who came to Denmark in 2014-15, were abled bodies. They are people who come with degrees. I have even interviewed architects who are now running a van company because they didn't have a way of making their degree, you know, being recognized, or they were not given a chance in an architectural firm. They plead with the government to say, please, you know, let's try and create a way in which skills can be appreciated. What people bring to this country is important. We cannot just erase what they bring to this country as if they come with a, you know, with a blank sheet, with no experience, no skills, etc. But that is not, of course, the rhetoric and the fact that, you know, politicians want to put to the fore. So yes, the book traces this kind of dichotomies and these gaps and you know, brings to very clear visibility the political narrative on the one hand and the reality and the facts on the other.
Brilliant, thank you. And finally, my final question. And as this is the podcast of the European International Studies Association, and I mean, you've already started to talk about this in terms of sort of the challenges to our democracies. What can the rest of Europe and maybe beyond, right? We shouldn't limit ourselves just to thinking about Europe. What can the rest of Europe and the rest of the world learn from the case of Denmark?
I think it's a crucial question, Polly, and I've thought very deeply about it. And as I said, the book is not just about Denmark. It does refer to its implications for the rest of Europe and beyond. So let's start first with a very important takeaway from the book. And this is how these restrictive migration regimes can first be made politically palatable. So the techniques of governmentality in this case, but also to become even celebrated as something that governments need to do as exceptional measures in order to protect society, so, you know, social cohesion, but also in this, you know, case, the welfare state. So that's something very, very clear that comes out from the book. The second is that these harsh migration regimes and policies are not necessarily imposed in moments of crisis. You know, because of the historical durée that we discussed, this shows the case. But also, these policies are not necessarily only imposed by authoritarian regimes, right? The book shows that they are introduced incrementally, they are justified through narratives of welfare protection, gender equality, even, as I mentioned, humanitarian concern. So I think Denmark, to my mind, is a warning. And it is a warning about what I refer to as policy diffusion and, importantly, policy normalization. So what begins as supposedly an exception becomes not only normalized, but becomes a model for others to emulate. So I think this will help us understand where we come today. And that is, you know, these debates we're having about return, which was initiated by the discussion in Denmark a few years back on Rwanda, debates about containment and control, but also externalization. So Denmark is an important case that illustrates the stakes of resistance that we discussed. You know, anyone who seeks to challenge this regime will be punished, will be silenced. The challenges of these exclusionary policies require not only, to my mind, legal reform, but they require us to think through what it means to be responsible, not just as a state, in terms of the obligations that I mentioned, in terms of international human rights, etc., but to think about what it means to be in solidarity today, and importantly for the people we're talking about, what it means to think about belonging. So I hope that, you know, particularly students who are listening in will understand that this is really about the future edifice of the European migration regime, and also importantly about how our societies develop and whether we are going to have a rethink about, you know, the core of what Europe stands for, or whether we're going to let Europe slide into what we are witnessing, you know, at the transatlantic level in the US.
And let's leave it on that very uplifting note. Thank you very much for joining us, Michelle.
You're very welcome, Polly. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast. Feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.